Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and despite all the stuff exploding in the world, really the biggest story is last today, and that is the launch of The Intercept, which is the first part of the First Look Media project of the zillionaire Pierre Omidyar, and the one that I care about, the one put together by Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, and Laura Poitras. And on the line is Ryan Devereaux. He's one of the journalists on the very short list to start out with The Intercept, and he contributed to their first piece, The NSA Secret Role in the U.S. Assassination Program. It's at firstlook.org/The Intercept. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Very happy to have you here, and very happy to see this project moving forward. I'm sort of vicariously shaking in the boots of all the mainstream media people. I read a hilarious hit piece on Glenn Greenwald today at the Daily Beast, where he even has parentheses at the end of his accusation saying, actually, this isn't really right, and then moving on. And anyway, I'm just having a great time seeing this. It's the anticipation is as good as the journalism. It's a lot of
Thank
fun.
Thank you very much. Really, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, good deal. All right, so, and I have to add here how great it is that Marcy Wheeler is a part of this, and I would have been amazed and disappointed if they had not brought her on board. But that's how to make sure that all of your paragraphs are completely factually correct, is to have her look at them. If you ask me, she's sort of the ultimate check on what especially these government documents really say, as you well
Marcy
know, of course.
Marcy's unreal. She's a machine. She can just crank out these articles every day. They're so detail-packed. It's a privilege, a real honor and privilege to be working with her.
Yeah. She put aside her modesty, which she is very modest, but she put aside for just a moment the other day to list, here's some of the stuff that I got right that was later proved right about the NSA. These are not, you know, this isn't just, you know, great journalism she's done. These are all the things where she's saying, you know, I bet we're going to later find out X, and then that's exactly what comes out later. And the list is 20 long, and it's all the highest caliber stuff, of course. This is incredible stuff. So anyway, congratulations. May you, you know, live long outside of the walls of Guantanamo Bay Prison and prosper in your journalism. Great. So now, let's talk about this piece. It's the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. Tell us first about your sourcing for this piece.
Well, so the story is really based on three sources, three separate sources. Of course, there are the documents that former NSA contractor Edward Snowden leaked last year, that Glenn has been reporting on for the last 6-7 months or so. So there's a number of documents there that contribute to the report that we published today. And then there's a new source, a former analyst with the National Security Agency and a former drone operator with the military's elite Joint Special Operations Command, who came forward to describe some of the programs that he was involved in, spoke under condition of anonymity with us, sort of describe the way in which the NSA works alongside Joint Special Operations Command and the Central Intelligence Agency to sort of track people for drone strikes and night raids around the world in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. And then our third source, sort of backing up the other two, is a young man named Brandon Bryant. He's a former Air Force drone sensor operator. He was in the Air Force for 6 years, beginning in 2005. Flew missions over Afghanistan, Iraq, and eventually Yemen. Worked alongside conventional forces, and then eventually worked alongside JSOC in Yemen in the hunt for Anwar al-Awlaki. He got out shortly before the Central Intelligence Agency took over the hunt for al-Awlaki and killed him in September of 2011. Bryant has sort of come forward as a outspoken critic of United States targeted killing policy. So together, sort of put those three sources together, the documents, the Snowden documents, this NSA JSOC guy, and Brandon sort of comments, built a picture of what the NSA's role in targeted killing around the world looks like. Mm-hmm.
All right, now, so I'm really glad that I asked you that, because I thought I had your three sources, but you've clarified, I believe, that other than the documents, your second source that you talked about there, the unnamed JSOC operator, that he himself was a former NSA, so he's both,
yes.
So he was giving you both sides of the picture, is that correct?
Exactly, yeah, really unique source, and then, he sort of speaks to both sides of this sort of equation. Whereas with Brandon, I spent a good amount of time talking to Brandon, and he was very interesting because these programs are so compartmentalized. And Brandon, as this Air Force, what he called a stick monkey, basically the sensor operator, is the guy who runs the cameras for a drone. So he shines the laser, if you will, on the target, and then someone else takes the shot. But Brandon, didn't really have any idea who was providing the intelligence to his crew when he was working in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen. But this other source that we had, had the very unique experience of sort of seeing the intelligence side of things, as well as the Joint Special Operations Command, really, the most elite sort of military command out there. Mm-hmm.
All right, so now, the bottom line of the story really here is that there's a high demand for dead bodies at the hands of drone operators, so they got to come up with lists of people to kill, and the way that they come up with the list is what?
Well, so what our story talks about is the way in which the National Security Agency has developed this technology for analyzing metadata and tracking cell phones, which basically allows them, with a sort of device that's on the bottom of a drone, to track a person's cell phone within 30 feet of their actual location. And what our source revealed, our NSA JSOC source revealed, that was so disturbing about this technology, is that he says that strikes are often taken when the sources of intelligence are only based on NSA electronic surveillance, so there isn't a human intelligence source confirming that the person on the receiving end of the drone strike is the person they're intending to target. What he basically told us is that this technology confirms that you're shooting at the cell phone or the SIM card that you want. You don't know who is holding that cell phone or SIM card. And he said, in some cases, you might know that you got the target, but he participated in operations where the target was known to have been killed, but not the people surrounding him. So our sources' concerns are really that there's been an over-reliance on this technology, and in the absence of human intelligence, the CIA and JSOC are launching missiles at people, sometimes without really knowing who they're firing them. They're firing them at pieces of technology, which is obviously a concerning development and something that, people who follow targeted killing operations in places like Pakistan and Yemen have sort of believed was going on for a long time, but we've never had the confirmation with the level of detail that the source and the Snowden documents provided us. Mm-hmm.
Well, now, so it seems like this is one of those things where kind of anybody could know better if they were interested in trying to know better, because, you know, as everyone knows, human minds love to see patterns even where they're not really patterns. And we can come up with all kinds of explanations that seem to fit, that seem to make sense. And that's an okay way to find the truth sometimes, if you're willing to change your mind and admit that maybe you're wrong or something. But people can convince themselves of all kinds of things. And it sounds like basically what we have here is sort of an automated conspiracy theory program where the computer spits out that, like, oh, yeah, you know, when you have a pattern of cell phones that talk to each other like these cell phones do, that usually means people that you should shoot missiles at. And then you have people who are deferring to the brilliance of the machine and its choosing, at least to a degree. And so then the technology kind of makes it all clean. But nobody really, I think you talk about in the article here that after they kill people, then they go back at least some of the time. And the New York Times talked about this back a couple of years ago. And they do a posthumous review to see if maybe you were innocent. Not that that's going to do you much good at that point.
It's incredibly backwards. And, you know, what was really interesting that our source told us was sort of familiar. If you've looked at some of these other whistleblower cases, Chuck Manning, Edward Snowden, when he tried to raise concerns about the problems that he identified in the program, he was just sort of shut down. And he was basically told that, you know, Signals Intelligence never lies, and that JSOC wouldn't be spending, you know, millions of dollars to kill these people if they didn't know exactly who they were going after. But in his experience, as he described it to us, you know, he regularly saw situations in which he had no idea who was on the receiving end of the strike, just that the technology that they had been tracking was there.
Does anyone know the percentage, or at least what the government claims the percentages are, of signature strikes, so-called signature strikes, where, well, he's a fighting-age male with a rifle, seems like, and he has a cell phone, and so, yeah, he must be the guy we're looking for, compared to ones where at least they claim they really do know who they're shooting and that they have a reason to do so?
No. This would be a great thing to know. It would be a very helpful thing to know, and it would be a real step towards transparency if we had some sort of breakdown of the intelligence that fed into different strikes. But that just hasn't been the case with this administration when it comes to its targeted killing policies. A few months back, the White House, these two reports came out, these big human rights reports, one from Human Rights Watch on strikes in Yemen and another one on strikes in Pakistan by Amnesty International. These very detailed strikes that came at the same time that the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counterterrorism was giving his preliminary findings in the investigation that he was doing on civilian casualties from drone strikes. All of these things 2 months ago, and this is sort of talked about in the piece that we wrote. This is how Brandon came to address the United Nations. There was this confluence of activity surrounding targeted killings. There were the reports, there was the United Nations preliminary findings, and at the time, the White House was under a lot of pressure to respond to these reports and these allegations of civilian casualties that had been really mounting for years. And what the White House said was that they maintain a list, a number. They have a number of civilian casualties that have resulted from U.S. drone strikes abroad. And that number is significantly lower than anything that has been publicly reported.
All right, I'm sorry, you've got to hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Ryan Devereaux from The Intercept. firstlook.org/The Intercept. The NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program is the new piece, the first one. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right. Goddamn commercial interrupted. I'm talking with Ryan Devereaux. He's a contributor to the first piece by Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept. Brand new venture. firstlook.org/The Intercept. And the headline is the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. And when the commercial interrupted, Ryan, you were explaining that the administration claims that the number of civilians killed in the drone wars is lower than tabulated by, I guess, the Bureau for Investigative Journalism or Human Rights Watch or even the New America Foundation. Is that correct?
Exactly. They say that the number is significantly lower than anything that's publicly available. But they won't disclose what that number is because that would create a risk to national security. What's fascinating, though, is that at the time that they were saying this, say last year, sort of the same time that it would look like we might strike Syria over the chemical weapons attack. And at that time, the administration was relying heavily on the same sort of human rights organizations that it was discrediting to build a case for intervention in Syria. But then when it comes to being asked about civilian casualties as a result of the drone program, suddenly those same organizations became less than credible.
Yeah.
So to your sort of point about, or your question as to whether or not we have any information that breaks down the different types of strikes that the United States is involved in abroad, we just, the transparency on the part of this on this administration has been sorely lacking.
Right. Well, and you know, I think part of this really is sort of, and you guys talk about this in the piece, right, is this overconfidence in the mechanism here, basically. And then since there's no built-in review process, there's no real reason to look back most of the time unless they get in trouble over a real bad one, like hitting a wedding or something like that. You know, one that, real bad meaning one that makes a, gets a lot of publicity. They just, but they have a lot of confidence in the brilliance of this thing. And I remember, I believe this is the very same sort of story of Gareth Porter's work in Truthout that he won the Gellhorn Prize for about the Delta Force raids and the Navy SEAL raids in Afghanistan at the height of the surge under McChrystal and under David Petraeus there, that they're using the same kind of data. And then there was even a whole lot of hype during the Iraq War, and Gareth Porter wrote about the Iraq, same kind of thing in Iraq, but there was a lot of hype about Bob Woodward saying, oh, their secret weapon was this network science about your father's brother's nephew's cousin's former roommate means there's a mark on your head. And where that's ridiculous to everybody else, to them, it's, wow, look at what we discovered, that if you just do the math right, you can blame all kinds of people for things. And that's the business they're in. And so they just go with it, even though to someone on the outside, it starts looking really wacky. Like, you guys are just caught up in you know, make-believe in a way. And in fact, the numbers, I mean, that's what Gareth showed, is that the numbers of dead civilians in Afghanistan show that, that, you know, just like your local sheriff's department, they got the wrong house, you know?
Well, and you know what's fascinating, I always think is really interesting about this sort of issue, is that the president has acknowledged, you know, in his big counterterrorism speech last May, the sort of temptation that is inherent in this kind of technology, especially for, you know, for a president, that this seems like a very detached, a clean way to do things, and obviously preferable to a ground invasion. And of course, that's a sort of false dilemma that we could only have drone strikes or ground invasions. But his administration seems to, at least in their public statements, acknowledge the temptation that exists with this technology, and yet they seem to have a really difficult time resisting it, or at least they had. I should note that, you know, drone strikes did drop last year in Pakistan considerably, but they went up in Yemen. So this program, it continues to go, it continues to roll on, and it'll continue to roll on after this administration. And that's something that people should be deeply concerned about, because there are precedents being set, and there are precedents that have been set in the last several years with respect to these types of operations that could really open the door, as if they haven't already, for some absolutely egregious abuse of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'll let you, if you would, please go into detail about shenanigans and Gilgamesh, but let's just say they seem to fit with this other news story that I saw today about this police chief from the Midwest somewhere, Dayton, Ohio, told the Washington Post, yeah, I want, he's saying airplanes, but could be drones or blimps or whatever, but ultimately implementing the Gorgon Stare, which is the what they try have been trying to implement, and they have different names for it, whatever, but total surveillance awareness over Afghanistan, that they want to bring these technologies here, and they'll always be able to point to a missing child or some other horrible thing as the justification for it. But we keep developing these kind of technologies, and we keep bringing them home. And, that could be really problematic, especially the way they talk about it here.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a whole industry for developing this sort of technology. There's a whole sort of world that's built around this sort of stuff that is all about, creating, designing, selling, promoting this sort of technology. But the programs that you were referring to, Gilgamesh and Shenanigans, are these geolocation systems that the NSA uses. The Gilgamesh is the NSA geolocation system, and then the CIA has a similar one that's called Shenanigans. And basically, the way that this works, technology that can be sort of acts as a fake cell phone data receiver, and it sort of stands in the middle, sort of man in the middle attack, as they call it, that sweeps up all sorts of information from people's cell phones, and then this is the means by which a drone is able to hone in on a cell phone or a SIM card within a distance of 30 feet or so. So it's really powerful technology, and of course what our source said, what he told us, is that in its implementation, during their sort of training with Gilgamesh, a point is reinforced to them, and that is that this is not a science, but this is an art. And that sort of told him that this is quite far from perfect, right? This isn't the kind of thing, these programs aren't always going to get you the person that you want. You have to kind of work with them and work around them. And when we're talking about stuff that has weapon systems that have lethal potential, and we're talking about a standard that the administration has set that they are never going to take shots unless they're as certain as they can possibly be that civilians won't be harmed, then there are all sorts of concerns raised about something that's an art and not a science. Mm-hmm. Particularly if there's not going to be human intelligence involved in confirming, that you are actually pointing a missile at the person that you want to point it at. One of the other things that I should mention that we found in our report, in our reporting, was that as of May 2013, President Obama had cleared 16 people in Yemen for targeting and 5 people in Somalia. And according to our source, before a mission is greenlit, that is, before a missile is fired, there must be 2 sources of intelligence. This is a really key point. I think both of those sources of intelligence can be electronic sources, so there doesn't have to be human intelligence. But once that 60 days runs out, if they don't take a strike, then commanders have to go back and basically resubmit their pitch for the target and resubmit their sort of evidence, right? And our source is concerned. What this sort of tells him is that it places a pressure on commanders, right, to take shots that might be risky because they could potentially feel that they might not get the shot again, right, and this can result in,
So it's supposed to be a fail-safe.
But you maybe also get the people around him, too.
Yeah, so it's supposed to be a fail-safe that these death warrants don't last forever. You only got 60 days. But what it ends up doing is it ends up encouraging the commanders to take shots that they might not necessarily take. Maybe they would wait for more information, better confirmation about who this person is or what they're up to. I was going to say, since this is all about their cell phones, why don't they just, and I know they have a lack of translators, but still, I mean, is nobody trying to tap these phones and maybe they could try to verify that way? They're like, yeah, no, I really heard this guy plotting to defend himself against an American attack somewhere or whatever the accusation is, you know?
Yeah, our source indicated that this is the tracking isn't based on the content of calls. which is really interesting and surprising.
Yeah, I'm just saying, why not? I mean, if it's their cell phone that's got your interest, go ahead and tap that thing. I mean, if we're assuming we're talking about, shooting talibs in Afghanistan or something like that, well, go ahead and make sure that you got the right guy as best you can, no? Or you don't want to waste a missile.
Yeah, true. Missiles are expensive.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the problem, is they do want to waste the missile, you know? Go ahead.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, these perverse incentives all over the place. That 60-day rush is one of those things where it sounds good at first, but did anyone think it through? And then you see what ends up being part of the consequences of that.
Yeah, it can really create a situation with a truly perverse incentive.
And then, I'm sorry, because we're damn near out of time. We got about half a minute, but I just want to point out that you guys talk about in the article here, Ryan, about how there are now more drone pilots being graduated than real fighter pilots, regular fighter pilots. And how they compare it to the atom bomb. This is changing the entire history of warfare for the world. I just thought if they're pointing that out, it's worth pointing out that people should notice that this is a real revolution going on here, right?
Well, I mean, it is fascinating. I tend to sometimes worry that there's a little bit too much emphasis on technology. Drones, after all, are a system. They're a platform. They're a weapon system. And what's really most important is the policies and the ways in which they're employed. Granted, yeah, this stuff has changed the game, but what really matters is the way that policies are implemented and whether there's transparency and accountability.
Right. All right, everybody, that is Ryan Devereaux. He's at The Intercept, firstlook.org, part of the brand new project and part of the brand new article with Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill. He's a contributor to it. The NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. Congratulations on y'all's first piece. Talk to you soon. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.